It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello, everybody. We begin today with a conviction of the so-called cannibal cop. Was he convicted for his fantasies rather than his acts? In the otherwise tabloidy case, we ask you to look past today's New York Post cover with Officer Valley pictured as a chef and the headline Chopped Liver. Look at the serious legal issue instead of criminalizing thought, of criminalizing violent fantasies rather than violence itself. Is that what happened here? Daniel Engber has been asking this question on Slate and joins me now. Hi, Dan. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks.
And, you know, I did not really follow this case. I want to say that first. I get all wonked out on things like the Ryan budget and North Korea threatening us with nuclear weapons. And I forget to read the cannibal cop testimony du jour. So for people like me, remind us of what Mr. Gilberto Valley was convicted of.
Okay, this is a New York City police officer who lives in Queens, who was on a beat in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and he was convicted of a conspiracy to kidnap his wife, his couple of his college friends, a high school friend of his, someone he didn't know, and the government argued that he was going to torture, rape, kill and eat these women.
Now, to be convicted of conspiracy to commit cannibalism, one of the members of your conspiracy has to have done something, not just thought something or discussed something, but done something that begins to implement the alleged plot. And the New York Post today, under the headline Dead Meat, quotes a juror who says, "Clearly, we believed his fantasy was going to step into reality," unquote. So do you question the jury's judgment about where the line is?
I do, yeah. I mean, it's one of these things where if you think he really was planning to do this, then that sort of colors the way you look at everything he did thereafter. And so I heard the same testimony as the jury. I was sitting in the courtroom. And just the plot sounded so silly that when they described the things that he actually did, they just, you know, sounded like no big deal. But to the jury, those things sounded, you know, terrifying.
What was silly?
So one of the things that he did, one of his overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy, was he traveled down to Maryland to visit with his college friend. He brought his wife along. He brought his baby along. His friend was actually the one who suggested that they have brunch and suggested the place where they have brunch.
This particular friend was one of the alleged entrees to be.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And in fact, in the days leading up to this trip, Gil Valley went online with his dark fetish friends and talked about how she was going to look delicious. He couldn't wait to see her. She would be mouthwatering. So he's talking about her in this fantasy, what I deem to be a fantasy context, what the jury has found to be a conspiratorial context. And then he goes down and he has brunch with her. Now, is that brunch an overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy? I think even if you believe that he intended to cook her and eat her with his friend at a Labor Day cookout, as was in his chats, I don't see what information, how this would help him to have brunch with her in Maryland. But again, it's one of those things where the plan just seemed so absurd that having brunch in Maryland is really nothing. But if you believe the plan, then the brunch is terrifying.
And listeners, were you following the cannibal cop case? Do you have a similar kind of reaction as Daniel Engber from Slate? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you have anything to say or ask about this case and the underlying legal issue here, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But as you tell it, all the jury had to do to find him guilty was hear the details of the fantasy. And some of these fantasies, I mean, unbelievable, like to roast a woman on a spit, stab through her womb, that'll get the jury's attention. Then see that his actions included searching the names of his potential main dishes online. And then, in fact, having enough of a relationship with this one friend, for example, where he does get invited to dinner. And I guess in some other cases, too, going to where they lived. I'm not completely clear on that. So how much more than that do you need?
Well, you know, in researching the background for my coverage, I came across a different case where sort of an internet involvement turned into a real-life attempted kidnapping. And I just thought it gave me a little bit of perspective. In that case, it's a guy in Massachusetts who sort of came on to a kid he was playing World of Warcraft with, and he was rebuffed and he became angry. He lined the trunk of his car with plastic. He bought handcuffs, rifles, knives, plastic restraints. He dug holes in his backyard. I mean, to compare one case to another. But I think that kind of perspective was missing from this trial. I mean, those are things. This is a guy who's planning to kidnap someone, and you know, thank goodness that he was put in jail.
The Daily News today, right next to their picture of a real-life jailhouse menu, vegetable soup, tuna or tofu salad, green peas, quotes the foreman of the jury who says, "We did what we had to do." And I think the implication was that they were protecting people from Valley because they considered him dangerous, considered him someone who just might act on his unappetizing dreams. You think it was preventive detention in that respect?
Sure. I mean, I think this is a situation where this isn't a regular guy. This is a New York City police officer, or a former New York City police officer. I mean, this was an issue in the trial. The government kept referring to him just in testimony as Officer Valley. The defense kept objecting because he's been suspended from his job. But I think that kind of thing really speaks to that question of, do we want this person on the street with a gun and a badge and handcuffs and a patrol car? To me, he's going to get fired either way. Even if he were acquitted, I suspect he would lose his job. But I think that played into it.
But the issue before the jury is not whether he's fit to be a New York City police officer. It's whether he committed a serious crime.
Sure. Yeah. The judge agreed with the defense that you can't just call him an officer over and over again without specifying that he's no longer working as a police officer.
Lisa in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, for all the women who have been killed with restraining orders, protecting them, legal restraining orders, which are totally dismissed and disregarded, this to me seems like finally a jury saying, yes, we can, in fact, protect a woman because someone has a thought to kill her.
And does that present any danger to you, Lisa, of falling off on the other side? If you're going to put somebody in jail for having thoughts, if there isn't enough evidence that they were acting on those thoughts, does that kind of make you concerned on the other side?
Well, what my feeling is clearly the jury felt that there was enough evidence. So, again, we go back to what is really enough evidence to say, mm-hmm. yes, this person is in danger. You know, when a woman has been attacked and the restraining order has been taken out, and then she's killed anyway. Mm-hmm. Well, clearly there was enough evidence. But until there's an action, you can't actually protect her. So this, to me, is the answer to that.
Daniel?
Well, I think Lisa makes a really great point about, you know, at what point you have to protect people, of course, against crimes before they happen. We can't just go around sit waiting until everyone does the most horrible things and then throwing them in jail. But Gil Valley was convicted of two crimes. He was convicted of conspiracy to kidnap, and he was convicted of unauthorized access of a government database. Now, that second crime, I think, sort of speaks to the stalking question. And the argument was that he was stalking his high school friend, although it's a little complicated because that high school friend was not actually one of his intended victims, according to the government. I think that might be cause for appeal. But that's a crime that he's been convicted of. He could go to jail for up to 5 years for. And I think that, to me, that speaks to this sort of protecting the victims of stalking.
Because you can go to where someone lives after writing about slow roasting her for dinner and using her head as a centerpiece. You can still go to where she lives, but only be indulging in a fantasy under the law?
Well, the question of whether he went to where any one of them lives is sort of up for grabs. He did drive to Maryland. Again, he had brunch with a friend of his. He already knew where she lived. His family was there. After being arrested, the officer who – the FBI agent who interrogated him said – testified that Valley said he'd been on the block of one of his intended victims, but there was other testimony that went against that. So that was a little bit confusing in the trial.
Could you have convicted him of stalking, at least, in a case like that, if he did go there?
You're beyond my knowledge of the law on what stalking rules are, but I know that it seemed like there was a good case against him for this unauthorized database access.
Anne in Greenport wants to talk about the database, I think. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. I think going to this database looking for victims just shows his intent to make this more than a conspiracy and go through with his actions. So I would have voted him guilty on the jury.
With the jury. Uh-huh.
The other thing I had heard, I don't know if this was true, I heard somewhere that he had also investigated buying a larger grilling rack or some huge grilling rack.
Do you know about that, Daniel?
And if that's, I think that also is an overt action.
Right. But on the question of the database, I guess the issue that Daniel is trying to raise is, well, just because you go to a database and you look at somebody or something on a database, that is not acting to kidnap somebody. That could just be part of the way that you're indulging your fantasy. So in terms of reasonable doubt in a criminal case, why do you come down on the side that you did?
If he was looking up particular names for victims, that shows that it was more than just fantasy, because once you are putting particular names, you know, to it,
then it's an
action. I mean, because maybe, you know, what would have happened with, the fellow who shot, who was thinking of killing, what's her name? You know, the actress.
Oh. You mean the Jodie Foster case?
Yes, Jodie Foster.
Uh-huh. And thank you very much. So, Daniel, there I think you're going to go round and round, and we don't have time to keep going round and round, but I think we have a perfect example, hearing Anne and hearing you, how it falls on one side or the other of perception, how you perceive the fact that he went to a database.
Well, can I talk about the Google searches? Because I think that that's very similar, of course, to looking up names in a police database, to look up names in a public internet database. He already knew where his alleged victims lived and what their birthdays were and all the information he could have gotten from the police database. So to me, it was similar to what he did, entering their names into Google. But I think that entering things into Google just as you think them I think that's an experience that many of us have had. In fact, in his pages and pages of Google history, he typed things in that were not really searches, but just sort of statements about what he was feeling. He wrote, "I want to sell someone into slavery." And his wife did the same kind of thing. And I wonder if, you know, why we would think typing something into Google is an overt act as opposed to writing fantasies in your journal.
And the caller mentioned something about buying a bigger grill.
Sure. He searched for all kinds of things: how to abduct a girl, how to make chloroform, big cooking tray, biggest cooking tray, carving knife, roasting spit, barbecue, recipes for human flesh, that kind of thing.
But this is all potentially an online game. This is World of Fleshcraft.
Well, he was also writing short stories online with his friends from this online fetish community. I mean, explicitly crafting stories with them. And so, you know, I do a lot of searches, weird searches, writing stories for Slate magazine.
If this is a community, are there other people being convicted of similar things or trying to commit them?
Well, there are thousands of other people who are interested in cannibalism, who are part of what's called the vor fetish community, vor for, I guess, devouring. But the people who are at risk now are the people that Gil Valley was talking to online. Two of them are in custody already. One of them in New Jersey will be on trial at some point before too long.
In connection with the same conspiracy involving him.
Mm-hmm. This very conspiracy.
And does it happen over again? Because I know you research these communities for your story. Does it happen over again that people get arrested for, you know, taking similar kinds of actions or non-actions, and they actually get dragged into court?
I think this is unusual. I mean, if you just look at these online fetish communities, they're not really doing much to cover their tracks. There's a disclaimer on the homepage that says it's all fantasy, but they haven't seemed so worried so far.
Unfortunately, a caller hung up. Let me see if that person called back. Somebody wanted to relate it to terrorism charges.
Oh, yeah. Great comparison.
Because, of course, there have been these cases where people have been at least charged and in some cases convicted, and the question is, were they indulging their fantasies in conversation, or were they actually taking steps to commit acts of terrorism? You see a parallel?
I do. I mean, those cases are complicated by the fact that law enforcement is often involved in kind of bringing those fantasies along. And in this case, Gil Valley was completely on his own with his friends online. The FBI only looked into him after the fact. So that's the line there, I think.
So do you think – is one of the reasons that you were interested in this because you think it has implications for other kinds of thought crimes, or is this solely limited to this bizarro world that you've now become familiar with?
I think it really comes down to this question of how are thoughts expressed online, and how do we think about what your behavior is online in terms of is that thought or action? To me, again – whatever you type in online is in the category of thought. People search for Google for whatever happens to cross their mind. I think it's often said that the internet, that Google, that our computers are extensions of our brains at this point. And if that's true, then what we do online, in a sense, is an extension of our thoughts. So that's the issue here, because I think what he said online and what he searched online was counted as an overt action in furtherance of its conspiracy.
And we just have a minute left, but it seems like from what you wrote and some things you were telling me before we went on the air that the defense was actually surprised here, that they had expert witnesses who they had lined up but did not call, presumably because they thought the prosecution did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was engaging in action and not just fantasy.
Well, to be clear, I think that they to the extent that they didn't call an expert witness, that they didn't have the defendant testify on his own behalf, that was risk management because, if they have their expert witness go, presumably the government can bring its own expert witness. So I it's not that they just ended their case early because why bother? But I do feel that I did get the sense they were surprised by the verdict.
And they can appeal?
Yes, they can. There are a couple of different issues that came up. One of them was sort of a bizarre technicality about jurisdiction. The government didn't make much of a case that Gil Valley did anything in furtherance of the conspiracy while in Manhattan. For some reason, the trial was in the Southern District. So there are a few issues there that might come up.
Daniel Engber, writing about the cannibal cop conviction and whether he's going to go to jail for having thoughts as opposed to committing actions, writing about it on Slate. Thanks a lot for coming in and talking about it with us.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, this week's, in a few minutes, this week's installment of Ask a Bioethicist. This week it will be questions about genetic testing and privacy. But right now we're going to have a call-in. As the cardinals do their business in Rome, does the next pope matter to your Catholic life? You can call us right now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, to Practicing Catholics. Does this pope or has any past pope mattered to your Catholic life? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.